Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the Bald Face Truth.
Gotta be honest, from the very beginning, when the Pac-12 conference said, hey, look, we're not going to play football in the fall, we're punting, I supported it. I supported that because I felt like the Pac-12 presidents and chancellors were making a decision that was consistent with the science and the data that they had in front of them. I also supported it because, hey, look, the Pac-12 was saying, we're not like the others. Okay, you decide for yourself what your identity is. So it made sense to me. But I gotta be honest, while we don't have enough sample size, I think we got the beginning of a sample size that suggests that the Pac-12 conference might want to start looking at the possibility of getting back to play. We'll get into what that would entail off the top of the show today, but I want you to tell me your takeaways from the weekend. We saw some NFL, Tom Brady, the Buccaneers-Saints game drew a huge Nielsen rating. Most watched game since the Super Bowl. That makes sense. Super Bowl was practically the last game we saw play. But it was a big game. Big ratings. Brady's legacy, we'll talk about that on today's show. We'll talk about college football coaches, including Mario Cristobal and Jonathan Smith. Where does their pay rank versus the other coaches in the Pac-12 versus coaches nationally? A lot of talk about coaching salaries. John Strong, the voice of American soccer, will be with us. We will talk more today about the wildfires that have devastated our state. I want to thank everybody on Friday who was part of Friday's show who reached out and made donations and continues to make donations. Even donations still coming in this morning and over the weekend to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund that the Bald-Faced Truth Foundation set up, raised more than $10,000 alone in the noon to three window on Friday. So I really appreciate everybody who made donations on Friday, those who reached out to their employers to see if they would match the donations, those over the weekend that helped spread the word. There are a lot of people in need. We'll talk a little bit today on the show about where some of those dollars are already helping. Anna and the kids and I went out yesterday to one of the locations where the families who have been displaced have been relocated, the Milwaukee Portland Elks Lodge, which is right on 99 there between Milwaukee and Portland, has become one of those destinations. And we went into the Elks Lodge and we got a tour of the place, and it is essentially turned into a spot where people who have been displaced, who have nothing to go back to, can go and put a tent up or park an RV or a camper, and they are given food and medical supplies and healthcare supplies and diapers and water and all of the essentials. We'll get one of the leaders of that effort who will be joining us in the 2 o'clock hour. But I got to tell you, it was really interesting because our board members and our advisory board members suggested that the Milwaukee Elks Club should be one of the recipients of some of the money, not all of the money, but some of the money that we raised on Friday. We want to disperse this throughout the state with some funds going to Southern Oregon, where there has been devastation in the Medford Ashland area, also some into Marion County, also some into the Estacada, Canby, outlying areas, Malala. There have been families who have lost everything in the Detroit Lake area, of course, and you know, a lot of people trying to wrap their heads around what it means. I saw a story this morning where in the city of Detroit, like 70% of the standing structures burned down between last Tuesday and over the weekend. So you have a devastation there that, you know, and I know that, you know, you and I can sit here and we can go, look, you know, hey, we have $10,000 to give away just from what we raised on Friday alone. Doesn't feel like very much when I look at the big picture, but it is something, and it is something that can help. And I can tell you from walking into the Milwaukee Elks Lodge and seeing the effect of the volunteers and seeing the effect of a lot of businesses that have made donations to them directly that they are passing through to many of the people who are there. And literally, our board members, you know, creating an emergency need and a grant request that resulted in about $5,000 of the money that was raised on Friday going to the evacuees and the people who, frankly, have nothing to go back to, who are sitting in the parking lot at the Elks Lodge, who have pitched tents, was heartwarming and inspiring to me. And I encourage you to go to the Bald Faced Truth Foundation Twitter account where you can see sort of where your dollars are being applied. I know about $500 that was raised on Friday went towards creating welcome bags for some of the people in Central Oregon or in the Detroit area who are seeking, you know, somewhere to go right when they arrive at the fairgrounds or right when they arrive at a Elks Club or one of the evacuation centers. They are handed a bag that is a welcome bag. And I want you to know that your donations played a big part in creating those welcome bags, as well as the people who are, you know, living essentially behind the Elks Lodge in the Milwaukee area now and are still there. As we toured on Sunday, I looked out the back window and I said, where is everybody? And they pointed out the back window and I looked out the back window and there was just a line of tents and people sort of milling around, families and kids. And it's heart-wrenching. And so if you are still somebody today who maybe didn't participate on Friday and you feel helpless, you want to get involved, you can go to baldfacetruth.org and you can make a tax-deductible donation today that will help families in need. The money will be earmarked for, really, there are three or four central locations in our state that many of the families who have lost everything that are ending up in. There's one in Southern Oregon, of course, in Marion County, people hurting. You know, there are people in across this state in the near outside of Salem, and of course, outlying areas that have just been devastated and continue to be devastated. The stories that are coming out of this are just horrific and heart-wrenching. But if you are somebody who wants to get involved, you can go to baldfacetruth.org. You can make a tax-deductible donation, and those dollars are liquid and able to very quickly get to the people who need things right now, need supplies, need diapers, need water, need distilled water if they have sleeping devices. There are people living in tents behind the Milwaukee Elks Lodge who also have sleeping devices that require distilled water. I didn't even thought of stuff like that. Shaving cream, socks, clothes, you know, even stuffed animals, stuff like that. There were just lots of people donating, lots of people in need. And so if you are somebody who wants to, if you feel helpless like I did on Thursday and Friday, and you want to do something, go to baldfacetruth.org and get involved. Big football weekend. I want to talk about what you saw over the weekend. I want to talk about some of my takeaways, my fearless predictions, feeling pretty good about some of them, not so good about my others. But in the end, I thought football kind of had an interesting weekend. I thought, you know, by and large, there's a couple things going on. You had college football Saturday, which really stole the scene, I think, from the NBA playoffs. And I predicted that on Friday. I said that I thought the NBA had sort of had its moment in the sun. And now here comes football, college football on Saturday, really in full force, and then the NFL on Sunday in full force, and the NBA playoffs got lost. They got pushed to the background. And I know the Clippers and the Nuggets, it's suddenly become a really compelling, interesting series, but it's just not getting the play that it normally would because everybody's kind of tuned in, whether it is out of pure sports starvation or whether it is diehard football fans who are looking for a diversion, or whether it was just people, in some cases, who were curious to see what the NFL might look like with no fans in the stands, or what it might feel like with no fans in the stands. I really feel like the NBA lost over the weekend.
lost the attention of the country, lost sort of the limelight. And I was thinking about the Blazers in particular because the Blazers kind of went out at the right time. If you think about it, I mean, just from a standpoint of, hey, we want maximum eyeballs on the product, the brand, Damian Lillard in the bubble gets the bubble MVP in that early part of this, you know, continuation of the regular season. They get into the playoffs and they're just overmatched by the Lakers. And about the time they're excused, I think most of the country, unless you are a diehard NBA fan, kind of shifted attention towards the NFL, college football. What is it going to look like? Is the SEC going to play? What's the Big Ten going to do? What's the NFL going to look like? How about Tom Brady? Is he killing his legacy by being in a Bucks uniform? So there's so many tentacles to this football thing over the weekend, and that doesn't even include all your blasted fantasy football leagues and all your survivor pulls. But in the end, I felt like football kind of had its resurgence over the weekend. And if I was a Pac-12 proponent, if I'm a chancellor or president of one of the Pac-12 universities, of course, you're still sticking true to your principal core values, which are, hey, these are student athletes. We don't want to endanger anybody. We feel like we made the right decision. But I think in the back of your mind, if you're being honest, there is a little voice that's going, did we get this wrong? Or is it time to reevaluate? Because as the Big Ten, all the speculation about the Big Ten meeting, are they meeting? Is it unanimous? Will they play if, three of the schools don't want to play? In the background, the Pac-12 has just been silent. It has been crickets. And the rapid results testing that was thrust on the scene about 10 or 14 days ago, now you've had a chance for the universities to sort of line up for their protocols. The equipment's getting put in place. We're told that the Pac-12 conferences, universities are going to have that equipment in place. But as I talk to coaches, as I talk to administrators across the conference, there are two things that are really in the way of the Pac-12 conference continuing to play. And one of them is the governors in the states of California and Oregon. Governor Kate Brown, Governor Gavin Newsom in California, both holding the keys to whether or not the Pac-12 conference teams can even hold a practice at this point. So until that happens, even with the testing equipment in place, even with so-called new protocols in place, the Pac-12 has six universities, the California universities and the two in Oregon, that are unable to even hold a meaningful practice. I communicated with college basketball coaches in our state over the weekend who told me that they were allowed to hold drills. They could do drills. They could do individual drills. They couldn't do full team activities. The football teams are in a similar position. And I know even as though Mario Cristobal has recalled his team to Eugene and is getting ready, like, hey, we got to be ready in case we're going to play here. I think there is a little bit of skepticism about whether or not the Pac-12 is going to get its act together. So here's the question I want to throw out to you off the top of the show today. And only you have the answer to this. You can only answer for yourself. Are you comfortable with the Pac-12 conference resuming play? Are you comfortable with the idea that you've seen the NFL teams seemingly pull some of this off? You've seen some of the college football programs pull this off, even though there are campuses that have widespread infections, who are in lockdown, who have sent students home. Is it possible that college football teams can operate differently than the rest of the student body? Have you seen enough to know that you're comfortable with the Pac-12 moving forward? Because the first problem that you have is the governors in the states of Oregon and California. And I'm told that those governors are looking at the Oregon Health Authority and in California health officials. They're trying to get clearance that would essentially clear them of liability should they bring students back to campus to participate in sports. So there's a little bit of bureaucracy going on there in the political world. Surprise, surprise. But that's the first thing that is in the way of college football getting back to play in the Pac-12. And then the second thing is it going to fit the mission of the Pac-12 universities and presidents? And underneath that umbrella, are they going to be comfortable? Are players going to be comfortable coming back to campuses, suiting up and participating? I want you to weigh in. Is it time for the Pac-12 conference to get off its butt and get back to playing football? Or are you comfortable with a little wait and see? Do you need to see more from the rest of college football? 503-417-7575 is the phone number. I'm of the mindset
that the Pac-12 conference here is now in a risky position. I didn't feel this way several weeks ago when they made the initial decision to go to a spring football season, or at least a January 1st start. But now that we know that they have rapid results testing, even though it hasn't been implemented, even though it hasn't been tested, I would like to see the governors in California and in Oregon, and in Governor Kate Brown's case, she has gone public saying she would not put Oregon and Oregon State at a competitive disadvantage. I feel as though we are bordering on a competitive disadvantage right now with them not being on campus, not being allowed to practice together. I would just like to see more data, more sharing of information publicly, more discussion. And yes, I know she's got wildfires on her mind. Yes, I know that she's dealing with a crisis of mismanagement of the forestry and mismanagement of this the wildfires that were out there. And you had the state's number one fire official who stepped down over the weekend in what is going to be a messy situation. You know it's just going to be messy. But in the end, the ultimate takeaway I have is that the Pac-12 conference needs to be more vocal, needs to be more outward facing with what its plan is at this point. And the governors in California and Oregon and health officials in those states, if rapid results testing is on the table, I think it's this week that you have to come out if you're the Pac-12 conference and you have to make some kind of statement about your plan. Is the plan going to be, hey, well, the testing will be in place by the end of September. We are looking at bringing students back for practices effective October 1st, and then it will be a wait and see. If we can get our 10-game schedule in, we could begin as soon as November 5th or November 7th or November 21st, whatever that plan is. I think the Pac-12 really is running a risk here from a public relations marketing standpoint at the very least. And at the very most, you're going to get hit in recruiting. You're going to get hit with, you're never going to recover from this messaging from the rest of the college football world if you don't come out and show people that you have a plan. Because right now, the plan is murky. It's what John Wheeler of the Bay Area News Group is writing about. It's what we talk about on this show and some other Pac-12 markets. They're talking on radio about, all right, this is what we suppose is going to happen. I mean, I think this is like, you know, one of the places that you can get the most information on the Pac-12 conference is this radio show, as we had Dr. Doug Aukerman come on the show and talk about it, and he sort of outlined the process. But in the end, if you're the Pac-12, do you not need to think about getting busy here and getting active with what your plan is? I want you to tell me, what is your perception of what's going on? What should the Pac-12 be thinking about and doing right now? Or is it too soon to make plans? Do you need a larger sample size? Meaning, are we a week away from seeing some of the teams that suited up over the weekend get out and all of a sudden have to start forfeiting and postponing games? You tell me. 503-417-7575. Gotta be honest, I watched the NFL games. In particular, I was watching the 49ers-Cardinals games. I don't want to relive that nightmare. But the one of the takeaways I had, and even watching some of Tom Brady's appearance, I'll call it an appearance against the Saints, is that I kind of wondered about Brady's legacy. Like, I don't think it's in any danger, but I know I'm going to remember him in a Buccaneers uniform. Even Anna, so she looked over and she was like, Tom Brady in a Tampa Bay uniform. Wow, that's weird. I thought it was a weird thing to see. Second thing was the crowd noise in the NFL games. That piped in crowd noise that really didn't fit the action on the field was bugging me. It felt, no disrespect to the soccer people out there, but it felt like the buzz of the soccer crowd during play without the big punctuating roars when a goal is scored. And I felt like there were times where the officials made calls and I expected the home crowd to kind of have a murmur of a boo and it wasn't there, or a cheer or a groan. And it the atmosphere just wasn't there. And it was bothering me so much that I just turned the sound off and watch the game without the sound on. Judah Newby, did that any of that resonate with you?
The Seahawks scored a couple early touchdowns in Atlanta, and I said, hey, that's how you shut up a home crowd right there. You go on the road and score a couple early, and I'm like, ah, well, they didn't even show up in the first place. But it was a little noticeable, but I actually came away impressed with how Fox, CBS, NBC, they had a pretty sophisticated level of crowd noise. You know, NFL Films had been recording organic crowd noise at respective stadiums, all 32 teams' home stadiums, for the last five seasons, and they've repackaged it for broadcast audio purposes for this year. I mean, it's pretty sophisticated and impressive.
It didn't fit, though. It was still weird, but...
I think
advantage to the visiting teams. Like, you know what I mean? Because we're used to seeing that be a disadvantage, playing on the road. And some of it is, when you're not in a familiar place, you're traveling, you're staying in a hotel, and you're away from your family, and you're suiting up and you're playing in an unfamiliar place. Yeah, there's a disadvantage there. But I got an idea yesterday that the crowd plays a larger role than maybe I had previously given credit to the crowd for.
Yeah.
The actual crowd.
Especially in the fourth quarter of close games. Like, that's where it makes a difference. Like, all credit to Mitchell Trubisky for playing well, but when there's 60,000 Lions fans in there screaming at him, calling him names and insults, I don't think he's throwing three touchdown passes in the fourth quarter. I just don't. I really think it makes it easier, to your point. Fourth quarter, close games, visiting teams have a much better chance to compete and pull out wins, I think, because they don't have that same stress of, you know, decibels of crowd noise, you know, yelling down at them.
We saw a lot of road teams win in places that are not easy places to win. 503-417-7575 is the phone number. I want to know what your takeaways from the football weekend were and what you think of the Pac-12's plan. Bruce is in Portland. He's going to lead us off. Bruce, go ahead.
Hey, John, real quick. I think the NFL will get their crowd noise synced. I mean, it took the NBA a little bit, but I think they've got theirs down pretty well. So does the MLS. Despite what you said earlier, you still don't get the roar of the goal. But in regard to the Pac-12 and Big Ten football, I think those of us that are Pac-12 fans watched college Saturday, at least I know I did, just shaking our head wondering what the heck is the Pac-12's plan. You know, obviously the jury is still out as to what's going to happen as far as exposure goes to these athletes and how much the transmission of the infection is going to spread. But all in all, you know, I think they had a pretty good weekend. I mean, the big experiment started, and we're on the outside looking in, being a Pac-12 fan. And like you said earlier, they're, at least the Big Ten is going to get together and vote. And they realize they're missing out. They're missing the boat here. I think the Pac-12, I was on record earlier saying they jumped the gun on canceling their season when they should have just postponed things to wait and did a wait-and-see attitude. Right now, there is, like, nothing coming out of Larry Scott's office, and everybody around is just going, what the heck's going on? I mean, California's positive rate is down to 4%. Oregon's is right there, too. It's like, what and when are you going to start talking again, and what is the plan? What is it going to take to get going again other than the fast, you know, even the fast testing? Is that all it's going to take? I mean, students are going back to campus all over Oregon. School's scheduled to start in a week. As far as I know, all the students are expected to return to campus. And whether they virtual learn or in class or a combination of both, that's moving forward. So where are the sports?
I appreciate your passion there, Bruce, in Portland. 503-417-7575 is the number. Here's the thing. I'm with Bruce, and I don't even know where we could disagree, because what I want from the Pac-12 is just an idea of what they're thinking. And what I got in the last 48 hours is I tried to reach out to Pac-12 universities and coaches, athletic directors, people at headquarters, people in the governor's office in the state of Oregon. What I got was everybody sort of deferring to everybody else on what the decision's going to be. And I'm getting a little frustrated with it. I finally this morning asked Governor Kate Brown's office two questions. What are you waiting to hear and see before you can clear Oregon and Oregon State to get back to practice? And the second thing was, who is going to ultimately make the decision? Is it the Oregon Health Authority? Is it the governor's office? I'm told by the governor's office they will get back to me. I don't know if I'm going to get a real answer. I also talked to a couple of the reporters who are covering the Pac-12. They're all having the same problem in their respective states. In California, it's even worse. Nobody can get any information out of Governor Gavin Newsom's office. So nobody in California really knows what is it going to take to get the clearance. Now, Dr. Doug Aukerman at Oregon State told me that he's confident once they have the rapid results testing in place that they will be able to convince the Oregon Health Authority that, you know, there's a clear path here to getting back to play. I'm not saying that I agree that these teams should be back on the field competing, because there is a part of me that wants a larger sample size, but I'm not opposed to the Pac-12 universities if they can prove that rapid results testing works. I'm not opposed to them being back practicing, because I think it's going to take them, you know, as the coaches will tell you, 4 to 5 weeks before they can play a game. And so if you're going to get the, like, this is what I really would love to hear from the governor's office, from the Oregon Health Authority, and from the Pac-12. I would love to hear, here's the plan. Look, world, here's the plan. We're going to have the testing in place by the end of the month. Unless there's a massive hiccup, we will begin to bring teams back to campus to test this testing, to see if it actually works, if the protocols are effective, first week of October. It's going to take us a week or two, but then we will clear the teams to practice. And if there's no other hiccups, because I think you have to take baby steps, if there's no other hiccups, these teams could play a game in November. If they told the world that, I think it would pacify a lot of people who are eager to see it happen. And it also would satisfy those of us out there that are going, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to rush back. Hey, wait a minute, we haven't seen a big enough sample size in the Pac-12, or excuse me, from the SEC and the others, to know that we're out of the woods yet. But I would like to see the plan. Mark's in Portland. Mark, go ahead.
War Eagle, baby, SEC. I want to take this opportunity to apologize to Roy out there for even thinking that the Pac-12 was the equivalent of the SEC. The Pac-12 and the Big Ten need to quit with the it's really, to me, it looks like politics with the governors in Oregon and California. Everybody's playing sports. This virus is dangerous, but it's not dangerous to athletic young people like that. So we've seen the other sports come back, and they're doing good. The rest of the conferences are going to make it through this more than likely. They're going to have some hiccups like we've had in every sport. But I just watched this weekend, John, when guys were being carried off the field on a stretcher, you know, because they ripped their knee up or they got knocked out with a heavy contact. And thinking if those guys are thinking or worrying about catching COVID when they're playing football. It's to say that they're concerned about the safety of the players, to me, is an insult in the game of football. I mean, every other sport, I'll listen to it. But in the game of football, these guys make a decision on every play to risk bodily harm to play the sport of football. And we're allowing them to do that. I mean, we allow them to do that, and people profit and benefit off that. So when these people are telling me it's because of safety that the players are not coming back in the sport of football, that's just a joke to me.
I appreciate the perspective from Mark in Portland. Mike is in Portland. And I'll let Mike follow that up. Go ahead, Mike.
John, first of all, man, once again, man, we're asking football players to assume additional responsibility that the general student body don't have to bear. We shouldn't have to put that on the student athlete. You guys, by telling me that you want the college football player to play at all risks, you're telling me that the college education really ain't that important. You've been using that justification all these years for not paying them a salary that they get in this great education. But now when it comes to time to where there's a health risk, you don't even talk about the education no more. You want them to go out there and risk their lives. So I think you guys are being hypocritical.
Well, answer me this. Are college players the same as professional players? I think you and I would both say no, because they're not paid. We could argue and debate should they be paid. But the Pac-12 is essentially saying, hey, we really value the health and safety of these players. They're saying we don't want to play. But, Mike, if you put rapid results testing in place, are you more comfortable with them being out there?
Not if the whole student body is not allowed to come to school. Why should only a small segment of the student population be allowed to come back and participate when the rest of the student body, they can stay home and get their education online? That's not fair, man. Yeah. That's
well, you know, we all know, we know, we both know the truth, right? We know the reason why. It's money.
Well, I know we know the reason. I know it's money. So you guys quit using that lame excuse about they getting a good education, because you guys now are demonstrating that you don't care nothing about an education. You just want entertainment. Once again, man, that's not fair. That's selfish. So
is Mike right? 503-417-7575. Is it selfish? I sort of take offense to that, because on one hand, I do support the players coming back safely and playing. On the other hand, I do think Mike has kind of a point there. I think there are a lot of people out there that watched NFL games and college games over the weekend who just said, hey, I want my entertainment. I don't give a damn if some of these players get coronavirus or not. They're going to be okay. Look, they're young. I hear a lot of that discussion going on. How do you balance that? How do you rectify that in your mind? I think it's a great discussion. But first and foremost, I just want to know from the Pac-12, what is the plan? And if their plan is, you know what, we just don't feel comfortable, then at least we know their plan. John Strong is coming up, broadcaster, sports, all sports, college football, college, all college sports, pro sports, soccer. I don't want to make him just the voice of American soccer, because he's not anymore. He's got some football in his holster. He's coming up next. My favorite broadcaster on sports, soccer, college football, it's John Strong, Fox Sports, play-by-play, formerly of this radio show. I noticed the crowd noise at the NFL games. John Strong is with us. As a broadcaster, Mr. John Strong, how much does that crowd noise affect a broadcast, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I don't know what it means to have football in my holster, but it sounds like something I should seek medical treatment for if it persists for 4 hours or more. It's an interesting question because, you know, we experienced that at the MLS's back tournament starting in the summer, and I actually requested to have that fake crowd noise in my headset because it gives you energy, or more accurately, if you're in a stadium and there's no crowd there at all, it zaps all your energy. And certainly if you're in a situation, it looked like all the NFL announcers were on site at the stadium. I know it was more of a mix with college football Saturday, who was on site and who was either in the studio or in some cases in their home. But that's sort of doubly so, that it sucks your energy away. And so even though you know it's fake, just to have something there, I do think just sort of helps amp you up a little bit. And it's between that and, you know, I know Fox has been working on the virtual crowd, which we've seen in baseball. I know they were testing it on, I think it was the Bears-Lions game over the weekend. I mean, things like that just to, it's like a comfort blanket. You know what I mean? If you tune into a sporting event and it's dead silent and you don't see any fans in the stadium, it just, it almost makes you uncomfortable, you know, because we're so used to that. And it is a reminder, as much as television drives so much of what professional and collegiate sports are, because that's where all the money comes from, or at least most of it, this all serves as a continued reminder of how vitally important to sporting events and even to watching sporting events on television the fans in the stands really are.
John Strong with us, Fox Sports, play-by-play. 49ers-Cardinals games, camera angles were really tight. They couldn't help but show the goalpost shot with the cutouts behind it. When they did a wide shot, they really talked about the fact that, you know, there's nobody in the stadium. It was a really wide shot, like that Goodyear blimp shot. But what bothered me was, like, you know, when I expected there to be a murmur in the crowd or a little roar or a boo at the officials making a personal foul call against the home team, it just wasn't there, and I noticed it. It was distracting me.
Yeah, and it's... Now, I did not watch the afternoon games as closely. I was watching the morning games, and in the afternoon yesterday, I was down in my office getting some work done for our game Wednesday night. But, you know, one of the things that we've seen is you can, with the fake crowd noise, and listen, the crew that we have that's been working on soccer for us, and I know they've than trying to get them to work on other sports for Fox. I mean, these guys are high-end. The guy that runs it runs the sound production for the Hollywood Bowl, has been involved in some high-level, you know, music production. I mean, these are guys who really get it, and they've got some serious equipment. And you can play in soccer, you know, crowd chants and songs. You can press the button for a cheer. You can press the button for a boo. But it's hard to get those timings right sometimes, and it's hard to also, you know, what's the appropriate sound for in soccer, a shot that hits the post? What's the appropriate sound for in football, an incomplete, where the guy's wide open and the pass has sailed beyond him? You know, how do you quite match that? It's really difficult to do, and so that's where, yeah, it provides some level of comfort blanket, but it's never going to really ever approach the emotional, visceral reaction to all these moments in between the very obvious, you know, yay, that happened, or boo, that happened.
John Strong with us, voice of American soccer, among other things, soon to be the voice of American football. John, let me ask you, the for years, broadcasts were done, you know, even you could go back to the 1950s in baseball where they had two pieces of wood, they hit it together, the crack of the bat, crack, you know, and then they would simulate the game using a ticker tape or whatever. But you know, we got used to having the broadcasters in the stadium. What is the advantage, disadvantage, the feel from a broadcaster's seat when you aren't there? Maybe you're in a studio somewhere else.
I think this is an incredibly fascinating conversation. Now, I think sometimes, you know, does the average viewer at home know? Does the average viewer at home really care? But it is interesting, as you've had this proliferation of websites like Awful Announcing, or you have different writers who have sort of taken on these roles of being media critics. And so there's more conversation about these types of things because you're right. In the early days, any time a baseball team was on the road, it was a reproduction. And any of the big, you know, guys like Vin Scully and Harry Carey, the legends of baseball broadcasting, all worked for a certain time reproducing radio broadcasts, as you mentioned, using fake sound effects. They're reading a ticker tape. So if anything, we've sort of come full circle that we have more and more broadcasters now working in a studio instead of in the stadium. In American sports, it's very strange because it's a very rare thing to have the announcers not at the stadium or in the arena, and it's been seen as an example of cost-cutting and an example of the business model failing in broadcasting and cord-cutting, all these sorts of things. Globally, it's very much the industry standard. When you watch an Olympics, 90% of the play-by-play of the events is being done from NBC's facility in Stamford, Connecticut, which is basically like a gigantic IKEA that they've set up to run broadcasting. I've called games that have been played on six continents for Fox in my 8 years working for them. And 90% of them, certainly the ones not in the U.S., have been done from one of two studio facilities in Los Angeles. Think about any big soccer game when Real Madrid plays Barcelona and it's broadcast in 200 countries. Not all 200 countries worth of broadcasters have sent their announcers to the stadium. Now, to your point about it is a performance art because you lose a natural amount of adrenaline energy because you're not there amongst the crowd. That was something I learned early on. You have to amplify your own energy, even if it feels like it seems ridiculous that you're shouting so much in a cavernous studio. You have to do that to match how you would sound if you were there. You also have to account for what you cannot see. And that, again, is a learned skill. I can't necessarily see whether the flag is up for offside. I can't necessarily see what the referee has pointed or what he has signaled when he's blown his whistle. I was watching it was the Iowa State versus Louisiana game Saturday, the early game on ESPN. And there was a situation where you had both announcers were not there. One was at his home in Atlanta. The other, the analyst Mike Golick, was in Bristol. And it was one of those situations where the guy's reaching for the goal line, the ball pops out, another teammate picks it up, he tries to get over the goal line, and the camera shot is so tight, you can't see the officials. So you can't see what the call is on the field. And both announcers were completely lost in that moment. They didn't know what to say or what to do. In the stadium, you could see what the call is and be able to talk through that. And so you learn how to basically sort of tap dance for a second or two or longer until you can figure out what has happened. Then you can sort of talk about that to the viewer, because the risk is, this is another thing I was taught, the worst thing is to guess and then get it wrong and to say touchdown and then 5 seconds later, oh, never mind, he was actually down. And that becomes a really difficult thing to adjust to, and it's a big adjustment for a lot of these football announcers that are doing this for the first time.
John Strong with us, Fox Sports play-by-play. What was it like for you after a time off to get back calling a game?
Similar to the guys getting back playing games right now. Similar to a lot of the drop passes and blown coverages we saw in football over the weekend. When you get out of a rhythm doing it, it takes time to pick it back up. And this was different than even an off season, where, okay, I'm not calling games for 3 months. But there's sort of, I don't know, there's just a weird psychological difference in everybody starting from scratch and you work your way in, where we all felt horribly rusty for the first couple of weeks doing it in July. And we started to sort of figure it out a little bit. There's going to be a change for me even this week. So our next game is Wednesday night. Timbers are at San Jose on FS1. And this is the first time I'm going to be doing the play-by-play from Portland. I had been the last couple of weeks flying down to L.A., basically because our attempt to work something out in Portland didn't work, and so we just sort of, let's just not worry about it now. And we've been able to revisit it with 10 days between games, and so it's going to be another adjustment for me. I'm going to be in a sort of a makeshift studio facility, sort of just down the street, actually, from Providence Park. Stu, my analyst, is going to be in the studio in L.A. Alexi, who's part of the broadcast as well for these, will be in L.A., and so not only am I calling games off monitor, but now I'm not in the same room as Stu, and I'm using sort of a camera connection to have some sort of eye contact and, you know, adjusting to sort of being that much more isolated. And so it does. It makes you sort of, again, a lot like the players. If you're not necessarily sharp and fresh and dialed in the moment, you're that much more sort of digging into, you know, your hardwired old habits of how you learned how to do it and sort of try to build that continuity on your own as you get into it. But it definitely, it takes time. It's going to take football teams. It's all well and good to sit here and say they need 6 weeks of practice. You still need some time, whether it's because you lost preseason in the NFL or because you were just doing nothing as a college football player. It's still going to be a couple of games before it really starts to resemble what we have come to expect. That's what we've seen in every single sport.
What do you make of the balance between, hey, we want everyone to stay safe, we really don't know the long-term health effects of those who do test positive, versus, damn it, these are professionals, they're under contract, they got to get back to work. How do you balance that?
Well, your phraseology is interesting there, because it speaks to one of the real issues right now, which is college football, because you can do that. I mean, it's not dissimilar from concussions, where there's a level at which you can sort of justify in your own mind, hey, everyone's getting paid, everyone understands the risks, everyone has signed on for it. We've had individual players in the NFL come out and say, I'm well aware of the long-term health risks, but I have a short window in my career, and I'm going to maximize my opportunity and make as much money as I can. And those are grown adults making those decisions. And in saying that, all of us, with football in particular, have, over the last 5-10 years, as concussions, CTE, all these different elements of it have become more prevalent and well-known, we've all made some sort of a negotiation in our mind with what our comfort level is or is not with regards to the game. College football is a whole other can of beans. When you're talking about kids, and they are, I'm a firm believer, having gone through this fairly recently, you're not an adult till your mid-20s, at least. and so these are kids, and they're not getting paid. And, you know, we're asking them to do all, it was already sort of a messed up system, and now triply so. And listening to the calls in the last segment, you know, and it's not just whether or not they're playing. There's so much money affected in it. There's so many jobs that are affected by it. There's so much of our, you know, what this has come to remind us is how important sports are to the social fabric of our lives. So many, any of us listening to this radio station, sports are a big part of our lives. And for a lot of us, you and I, sports are how we provide for our family. And it becomes difficult in these moments to really know what the right answer is. I mean, I struggle with that with soccer of, you know, I don't want to force these guys to play, but if they're not playing, at a certain point, I'm not providing for my family now. And it just, this whole pandemic and sort of how it has unfolded has really created some awkward situations at best and some really awful situations at worst of the role that sports plays and sort of how we approach whether or not the athletes, who at the end of the day, they're the ones that are the most important element to this equation, should be on the field or not at all, and in what scenario and with what sort of, you know, procedures or protocols around them.
John Strong, Wednesday night, Timbers against San Jose on Fox. Is that where we're going to see you next?
FS1, Wednesday night, 6:30 p.m.
Thank you, sir, for making time for us, and I wish you the best. Stay safe.
You as well. Good to talk to you, bud.
There's John Strong, Fox Sports play-by-play. Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth. Every day on the show, we do our big splash. It is the one thing that you need to know, and today's no different.
This is
the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it.
Where?
Down there.
Must be
the big splash.
Well, I don't know if you were surprised by Tom Brady's performance in week one, but Buccaneers coach Bruce Arians said today that he was surprised that Tom Brady struggled in his debut with the Bucs on Sunday. Brady threw two picks, including a pick six in a 34-23 loss. Arians said he looked like Tom Brady in practice, so it's unusual to see that in a ball game. I thought of something there that I hadn't considered before. I've been focused a lot on what Brady was going to look like, what the Patriots are going to look like, but I hadn't considered that if Brady looks bad, how it would reflect on Bruce Arians, the Buccaneers coach. Is he the one that ends up losing here if Brady doesn't play well? It's our big splash, and it's the one thing you need to know. 1 o'clock hour coming up. Leave it here. Hey, it's Canzano. We'll get you back to the podcast in a moment. It's brought to you by Shoe Mill. Go to ShoeMill.com or any of the Portland or Salem locations if you want to see great shoes. A while back, I picked up my first pair of Kizik's at Shoe Mill, and it's changed how I think about shoes. Kizik's are the shoes you literally pop on without bending over. No lace-up required. Their patented heel technology collapses and rebounds, and it secures the shoes to your feet. I've been sporting mine for about a year. They're the most comfortable and convenient shoes I've ever had. They're available for both men and women. Experience hands-free shoes for yourself at any of the Portland area Shoe Mill stores. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet. Now back to the podcast.
BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Man, I loved having John Strong on this radio show. FS1 Wednesday night. He'll have the call in the Timbers-San Jose matchup. But he could talk a lot outside of soccer as well as he did in speaking about the virus, broadcasts, stadiums. Really good stuff. I had something I was thinking about, too, that others have written about sort of on a tangent. But I want to bounce this off Judah Newby, and I want to bounce this off Alabama Adrian. See, because these college teams and pro teams all have a team chaplain. And often you get players of faith who will pray before games or pray after games. You'll see the team chaplain who sort of holds this role on a team as, you know, the liaison between the team and maybe spiritual or ethical boundaries. And I've always viewed that chaplain as part of the team. I don't know if you've even thought of the team chaplain, but for years, Al Egg, who was the team chaplain for the Blazers and Portland State and others, he would walk around the hallways at what was then the Rose Garden Arena, and he'd pass by you and he'd say, "Too blessed to be stressed, John, too blessed to be stressed." And he was the guy, spiritual team chaplain. That was his role. Let's say you're the team chaplain for a Pac-12 team, and you know that you've got some ethical, moral reservations about players getting back on the field. But you also know that the college football coach wants to play. Like, I think the one thing that has been evident to me is the Pac-12 coaches are biting their tongues. I think they're saying the right things. I think they are out not trying to embarrass the conference. They understand they don't have control of this thing. And I think while they're watching the SEC and others play, they're biting their tongues. If you're the team chaplain, how would you handle when somebody asks you whether you think the players should be on the field? Because I see a lot of churches, including the church that we attend, that are not holding in-person services. They've gone online, they're Facebook Living, they're going virtual. A lot of the churches are doing that, and they're saying, look, as much as we know that people want to be in person, we, you know, feel an obligation and a duty to do this at a distance to keep people safe, and ultimately, you know, there is a moral or ethical issue there. Judah Newby, what do you do if I make you, let's say you're the team chaplain for Oregon and Oregon State? What, how, like, how do you feel, or how do you rectify? You know, I'm sure, you know, as a friend of mine just said to me, he texted me or during the commercial break, I asked him the same question. And he said, you could probably get 100 different answers from 100 different chaplains. But Judah Newby, if you're the team chaplain, how do you rectify your sort of spiritual and ethical and moral duty with your desire to be part of the football program?
Well, I've never thought about this before. I'm not sure what the, you know, modern day intersection of a professional chaplain is with a pro team or a college team. I don't know. It's a little different, I think, for pro and college, because, I mean, in pro, like an NBA locker room, I think of all the different religions that are represented inside that locker room. And it's, I mean, what does the team chaplain do? I mean, is he Christian only, or is he there to be able to support all the religions? I mean, I assume the same goes for a lot of the collegiate locker rooms, too. I mean, is he a counselor? Is he someone that just prays with you? But at the end of the day, like, a team chaplain, I would imagine, has to have his personal convictions and put them at the door. Like, his role is there not for him to share his own beliefs, but really it's like an emotional support role. That's how I understand team chaplains. It's not like a pastor of a church. It's just more of a emotional, you know, spiritual support. But I don't really think...
It's tricky, though, isn't it?
It's a little tricky, but...
It's a tough one.
I honestly, you know, obviously, you know, I'm a man of faith. I've got my own opinions on the intersection of the spiritual world and athletics. But I'm not so sure that there's a clear delineation, or if there's a clear responsibility of a chaplain in sports. You know, because historically, we've tied football. We pray before games and all that. And, you know, the faith-based part of me is like, for that, but at the same time, I've got a question, like, is that authentic? Is that real? Does that actually help? Is it just a show? And at the end of the day, it's not really for me to decide, but I, you know, if you're being paid by an organization to be a spiritual resource, I feel like in this day and age in the country, that can create a lot of different issues. Like, I'm normally in favor of it, but it does require a lot of, you kind of have to put your own
thoughts about it aside. I can feel how conflicted you are even listening like, to that.
Why'd you have to bring it up?
a lot of the chaplains are not paid, or they're paid, you know, a nominal fee, and they're sports fans who like to be part of the organization, but they're there sort of for the players to lean into before games, after games, and certainly to provide a resource for players. I've just always wondered, because the chaplain to me has always been sort of the head coach puts their arm around the chaplain and says, this is my person, and he or she is here to be, you know, sort of the spiritual, you know, pregame, postgame prayer leader. And, you know, if players need someone, gives the players an outlet for someone to talk with. But at the same time, I kind of feel like if the chaplain were outspoken and said, I have a moral issue with us returning to play when things are not absolutely safe. Like, for example, let's say the team chaplain's a pastor at a church that is saying, hey, our congregation is not going to meet in person. And that same chaplain is going, let's get college football going and get the players back to practice. I would expect that some of that congregation that's frustrated with services not being in person would have a bone to pick. And I also feel like if the chaplain came forth and said, look, you know, our church is not meeting in person, I don't feel good about the players coming back until I know there are no long-term health effects. I couldn't live, like, my soul couldn't be, you know, free of that responsibility if I advocated for players to be, you know, in person. So I'm going to say, you know, on the record publicly, I don't agree with this. I would expect like Dabo or, you know, Nick Saban or whoever the coach is to kind of go to his inner circle. That's not our chaplain next year. Like, you know, let's that guy's not in the circle anymore. I think it's a really tricky position. And I think we're all over the place still. And here's the other thing. Like, my phone blew up during the first two segments of this show from my own friends who happened to be listening, who were all chiming in with their opinions on what the Pac-12 should do. The phone lines, we saw a burst of activity when I offered it up for people to call in. And, you know, the phone, I don't think people could agree either whether they should play or not play. We saw opposite ends of the spectrum weighed in. And what I really do believe right now is that no matter what they do, whether the Pac-12 plays or doesn't play, no matter what the Big Ten does, no matter what the NFL does, there's still going to be 100 different opinions from 100 different people. And the truth is, we kind of don't still know what the long-term effects are. Even with rapid results testing, we don't know about the long-term effects. Now, I think we have to talk about this in different issues. Do we all love football? Yes, most of us do. Do we all want to see football? Yes, most of us do. We want to see football. We want to see good football. And we want that diversion, and we're going to tune in. I watched games over the weekend. You probably did as well. I didn't have any guilt in watching NFL games. I had a little tinge of, I hope they're doing the right thing when I watched the college games. And by the way, I thought the college games were bad. And I don't know if that was because they were rushing to play, they're not ready, or if we're watching mismatches and sort of a hodgepodge of, here's the schedule we put together, and these teams just aren't ready to compete yet. But I thought the college football was really inferior compared to normal college football. And I thought the NFL was inferior. I still thought we saw some hiccups, but I think it was a closer approximation of what actual NFL football looks like on a regular NFL Sunday. All right, Punch It Audio is coming up. We'll also talk about college football salaries with somebody who has launched the college football salary, coaching salary website. So we'll talk about that. Mario Cristobal, where does he rank nationally? Where does he rank in the Pac-12? What are the fun and interesting things that our guest at 1:30 has found out about college football coaching contracts? All of that coming up. I want you to leave it right here. Seen some really troubling images from the destruction of the wildfires across our state. You're somebody who wants to help families that are in need. I would encourage you to go to baldfacetruth.org. You can give to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. About $10,000 raised on Friday alone between noon and 3 p.m. during this radio show from across the state, from people in Eugene and Springfield and Junction City and Klamath Falls and Salem and Portland and beyond, people from out of state making donations. I appreciate and love all of you for taking care of people in the state that really need the help. If you were listening at the beginning of the show, we talked a little bit about one of the organizations that got some support. The Milwaukee-Portland Elks Club has become a destination place for some people who have lost everything. And they are gathering supplies, food, diapers, other things to give to people who have lost their homes. And many of those people are camping on site there behind the Elks Lodge in the back parking lot of the Elks Lodge. And Anna and I and the kids went over there on Sunday to bring some things over and drop some things off. And we also, with the advisement of some of our board members, dropped off a check for $5,000 to help support the families who have lost their homes, who have lost everything. We'll be talking to someone from the Elks Club coming up. We are also looking to help people in the Detroit area, certainly in Southern Oregon. We would love to continue to be able to pass those donations directly to people who are in need. Essentially, people who have lost everything. You can go to baldfacetruth.org if you would like to make a tax-deductible donation today. I was incredibly moved on Friday as we had people, one after the other, making donations at that website, really for 3 hours, and it continued on Saturday and Sunday, and even some donations that trickled in this morning via the website. If you want to make a tax-deductible donation, that's the place to do it. The support that you're giving, 100% of that is being passed through to people who are in need. And we'll talk more about that in the 2 o'clock hour. But if you're somebody who wants to make a difference, you can do it at baldfacetruth.org. There's no donation that's too small. We had people who gave $1,000 donations. We had people who gave $10 donations. It all really adds up. And I can tell you, we were inside the facility on Sunday, walking through. There were tables that were filled with healthcare items and socks and clothes and water and food and, toys for kids and diapers. And I literally saw the faces of some of these people who have lost everything. And they look hollowed out, understandably so. And then I looked out the back window of the Elks Lodge into the parking lot and I saw the tents. And there's some RVs out there. But it was the tents that drew my eyes, because I thought, here are people who are left sleeping in tents that they may have brought, little pop-up tents, little tents that they're sleeping on the ground. They have lost everything. I'm sure and I'm hopeful that insurance will help get them back on their feet, but they are in a time of need right now. This is the time. It's now. It's for the next couple of weeks. It's in this time of need where they really have nowhere to go that I think we can band together and help each other out. Go to baldfacetruth.org if you want to make a donation. Again, no donation is too small. Let's play Punch It Audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio,
presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
One of the biggest football games of the weekend, maybe the biggest in your household, Tom Brady and the Buccaneers playing at the Saints. Wasn't all good for Brady. Punch it.
Well, yeah, just some pretty basic mistakes in this game by Tampa.
On second and 15, this one's picked. Back the other way for the touchdown. It's Janoris Jenkins, a pick six.
Tom Brady giving up a pick six through two picks in the game. Bruce Arians, his coach, not having it. Punch it.
One was a miscommunication between him and Mike, and he thought Mike was going down the middle. It's a different coverage. Mike read it right, and he should have bent across his face, but Tom just overthrew it. And the other one was it was a screen pass with an outlet called, and he threw the outlet, and it was a pick six. Bad decision.
Bad decision by Brady. I hadn't thought about Arians taking heat for this. And I love the fact that he's holding Tom Brady, Tampa Tom, responsible here. I think it's an interesting byproduct of this is to look at Brady go, look, in the end, is there more at stake for Bruce Arians? Because he's not Bill Belichick. And are people going to judge Bruce Arians harshly if Tom Brady doesn't succeed? It's worth thinking about. Kyler Murray looked really good for the Arizona Cardinals. They beat the 49ers in week one. Punch it.
So far today for Murray, the Cardinals leading rusher. He's going to try to run for some more here. Kyler Murray hops inside the 10. Murray turning on the speed, and Kyler Murray puts the Cardinals on top with 10:26 to go.
Really interesting game because the 49ers were without wide receivers. Arizona pretty much has Kyler Murray, DeAndre Hopkins, and that's about it. And it was interesting to see two coaches try to maneuver. My big takeaway in this game was not about Kyler Murray. Although I would say this, he is going to be incredibly difficult to defend. He's gained 15 pounds, he's tougher to tackle, and the way that the quarterbacks in this league are officiated, he becomes a really tough guy to tackle, and then, by the way, if he's sliding or diving, you can't make any contact with him. Drew a couple of key personal fouls, It's the way the game is called. I think he and some other quarterbacks in this league that really know how to utilize their legs are going to benefit. And Murray was very good in this game. But my takeaway was about Jimmy Garoppolo. He was tentative. Some of that could be blamed on the fact that the 49ers didn't have their wide receivers and were a pretty easy matchup. All you have to worry about George Kittle and some running backs out of the backfield. It turned them into a one-dimensional team, but Jimmy Garoppolo, inexcusable, missed a couple of big throws, including a wide-open throw that would have won the game in the final 2 minutes. Jimmy G did not look like a veteran quarterback in week one. He's getting a lot of heat in the Bay Area. Did not take a step forward from last season. Looked tentative. That can't continue if San Francisco is going to emerge as a threat. Seattle was at Arizona in week one. Russell Wilson acting like Russell Wilson. Punch it.
From the 38-yard line. Wilson wants it all. Deep ball. Metcalf got it. Touchdown, Seattle. On fourth down, they leave the offense out there and not only get the first down, they deliver a strike to DK Metcalf.
Russell Wilson, 31 of 35, 322 yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions, also ran for about 30 yards. Seahawks too much for the Falcons. Week one was fun. Andy Reid on last Thursday night had his face shield fogged up. He said it was brutal. I didn't see any face shields over the weekend. Did you see any face shields by any other NFL coaches, Judah?
I didn't see any face shields. No, I think people are masking up for the most part.
Everyone was like, nope, Andy looks stupid. Jamal Murray, Nuggets forced a game 7 with the Clippers. Here's Jamal. Punch it.
No, we all had that will to win. We went out there and showed it. Possession after possession, down 16 and a half. We came out ready, and that's what we got to have from the jump. So that's the only thing. But other than that, you know, the guys, everybody, like through the line, everybody that got in the game was just amazing. Guys on the bench were tuned in, and we were able to get the jump job and force the game 7.
Nuggets beat the Clippers 64-35 in the second half of this game to win 111-98 in game 6. They tie this series up 3 games apiece. I think the Clippers are the best team in the bracket. I still believe that. That said, I looked at what the Nuggets did in the second half. They have now forced a game 7 in a neutral site against the Clippers. You got Nikola Jokic, you got Jamal Murray, you have a chance. By the way, I didn't hear much from Michael Porter Jr. after this game. That's Punch It Audio. It is the best sound from all around. Up next, we're going to the state of Washington, where a legal firm that focuses on employment contract law has started a website that focuses on college football coach contracts. It's an interesting story for me. I want to get the backstory on it. I want to know what they've learned about college football contracts. They've looked at Mario Cristobal's contract. They've looked at Jonathan Smith's contract. They look across the country. I think it'll be really inside college football, and it's coming up next. Well, it's not every day that you get an email from an employment attorney office. Employment attorneys, well, they represent employees and industries, and they aim to help. But what's different about HKM is that HKM, as part of their website, you go to hkm.com/football, and if you do that right now, you will find all of the NCAA Division I football coaching contracts, the contract rankings. You'll find how much Dabo Swinney earned last year. You'll find an article about whether Tom Herman has lived up to his contract at Texas. You'll find an article that caught my attention about how much a Pac-12 or a Big Ten coach might lose this season if they don't play football. Jason Ritterreiser He's with HKM and is joining us now. Jason, thanks for making time. I appreciate it.
Hey, John, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This is so unusual for, you know, to see, like, you know, normally you wouldn't see employment attorneys getting into football. What bridged this together in your mind?
You know, hey, that's a great question. You know, it was kind of a labor of love just based on the passions of the individual lawyers at our firm. I came from the center of the state of Washington in an old town called Ellensburg. And grew up with some friends in sports who ended up in college and professional athletics. And so it's always been interesting to me. And Dan Kalish from our office, he and I would sit around and talk about college football contracts and employment contracts in sports. And so we had this wild idea a couple of years ago to start requesting these contracts, because despite the fact that they're public contracts, there's a lot of secrecy around college coaching contracts and what's in them and how much they're going to earn. And you can find rankings on the internet, but it doesn't tell the whole picture, because oftentimes those compensation packages either aren't attainable or there are particular clauses that make them unique. And so we started requesting these contracts, taking a look at them and finding some pretty interesting stuff. And we thought, you know, what a great idea to make these available to people. And so we put it on our website and it's kind of blossomed from there.
Go to hkm.com/football if you want to get there. You had one piece on there that it says, how much would a Pac-12 and a Big Ten coach lose this season? And yeah. You really look at the incentives there. What are you guys looking at?
Yeah, so when you look at almost any college football coaching contract, they're divided into kind of two categories. The first is their base compensation, what they're going to earn just by showing up to work. And then the second category you look at is this category of incentive pay. And that kind of can be broken up into on-field performance and off-field performance. And obviously, if they're going to be incentivized for on-field performance and they're not playing this year, they stand to lose those potential incentives. And those things are around number of wins, around whether or not they make a bowl game, whether or not they make it into the college football playoffs, things like that. And so if you look at the collection of, like, for example, Pac-12 coaches, every coach is looking at somewhere between $750 to almost $2 million of potential lost income as a result of not playing football this year. And so we break down those incentives and how they stand to lose that money, which is a pretty interesting thing to look at from an employment perspective, because usually we're not talking about employees losing money. But in this case, because there's no football, they lose all these incentives.
Mario Cristobal, for example, 9-win season would trigger a $100,000 bonus, another $100,000 if he gets to 10, $200,000 more if he gets to 11, $250,000 more if he gets to 12. That's a lot of money on the table, Jason.
It is, and if he were to win the Pac-12 Conference Championship, he'd have another $150,000 on the table. And because that's not happening this year, it's simply lost income. I mean, he could have earned, talking about Mario, he could have earned an impressive $1.7 million based on the incentives available at his contract that just aren't going to be on the table this year because they're not playing football. So it's unprecedented, but so is 2020.
Jason Ritterizer is with us. He's with HKM Employment Attorneys. On their website, you can see the database for college football coaching contracts. Dabo Sweeney, Nick Saban, Jim Harbaugh at the top of that. It got me thinking, like, would there legally be a case here where a coach could potentially have a lawsuit against a conference for not playing if the Big Ten or Pac-12 aren't going to? Is there a viable lawsuit there, or do you see that as a non-starter?
You know, it's a great question, right? Because you have a conference that's interfering in a coach's ability to earn the incentives in their contract. And so theoretically, you could have a cause of action for interfering with a contractual relationship, something like that. In reality, it's a non-starter, right? Because the last thing that Nick Saban or Harbaugh or any one of these guys want to do is to be involved in some litigation against the conference where they're, you know, playing football. And so I think it's highly unlikely. I think it's more likely that they would go back to school and talk about the lost income and come to some agreement with the institution to compensate them for a pretty unprecedented year. But one thing I want to point out, because you mentioned those top earners, one thing that's unique in contracts this time around is that they're getting these licensing deals, which are part of contracts sort of for the first time. And it's followed the NCAA's litigation about whether they should be paying college football players and whether or not they players should earn income for their likeness. In other words, their jersey sales and that sort of thing. And we're seeing that built into contracts now. It's in Dabo's contract. And those are some of the incentive pay that they're going to get anyways, even if they're not playing football, because their school is still using their likeness and their image.
Jason Ritterizer is with us, HKM Employment Attorneys. Jason, as I look at the website, you've got an article here on Steve Sarkisian's lawsuit in 2015. For those who don't know, Sark filed a lawsuit against USC claiming that he was improperly fired because alcoholism was a disability and then was therefore was protected under California state law. That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I followed that one particularly closely. I'm a dog from the University of Washington, so Sarkisian was around when I was around, and I followed that litigation closely. He, you know, borrowed sort of a traditional employment claim in a contract sense and argued that alcoholism is a disability for which he should be protected. And there's a lot of legitimacy to that argument. You can argue about whether or not it was a legitimate argument in his circumstance, but nonetheless, any individual ought to be protected if they have a disability in employment, and that was an argument that Sarkisian made and made convincingly enough to reach a resolution.
You had the attorneys there at HKM kind of looked through some of the contracts to find some weird things. Doug Martin, for example, at New Mexico State, no tobacco during practices or games. Steve Spurrier, he gets a lifetime appointment when he's done coaching. He'll be a special advisor to the president of the university. $100,000 a year for Spurrier. What else did you find out in looking at contracts?
You know, one of the terms that we found that I didn't anticipate is the lengthy negotiation over private jet hours and what those can be used for. It's, I think, pretty common knowledge that some of these coaches jump on private jets for recruiting trips, et cetera. But in many of the top earners, their contract also allows for private use of jet hours for their family, et cetera. So when you think of Nick Saban's family traveling to an out-of-state game, they're not jumping on a commercial airline. They're taking a private plane out of Tuscaloosa and heading to wherever Alabama's playing. So that was a term that was unique and something that I didn't really anticipate, and certainly something that I think most folks wouldn't realize are in these college football contracts.
Tim DeRuiter, who was at the University of California, Sacramento, was an independent contractor you guys found. How does that affect his employment status in that state?
Yeah, it's great. It's a great question. Obviously, independent contractors are treated differently than W-2 employees or regular employees. And so it can have a lot of effect on compensation. The largest one is a tax perspective. When you're an independent contractor, you owe both sides of that employment tax, which is like 15% rather than 7.5% for the employees, for the payroll tax. So from a tax perspective, that can have significant ramifications. You can also not be subject to some additional protections that employees are subjected to versus independent contractors. But what's most remarkable about these contracts is that every one seems to be unique and seems to have slight adjustments to what we would sort of consider a standard employment contract.
It's interesting because DeRuiter, as I look at him, it looked like he was fired at Fresno State. They probably owed him some money. There was probably an offset in his contract. Was there a potential advantage there for him being a contractor in the next job?
Yeah, definitely. So sometimes you see buyout provisions, and those buyout provisions are tied to subsequent employment, and how employment is defined can be important. And so on occasion, you'll see workarounds to subsequent contracts. So instead of a school having to buy out the coach from their previous contract, they'll try to make some argument that either they're an independent contractor or they're simply a consultant, or they'll delay a start time for the coach to prevent having to engage in these significant buyout provisions where the next school has to pay off the previous school for the coach's contract if they resign.
All right, one of the pieces here, and again, we're talking to Jason Ritterizer, HKM Employment Attorneys. You can go to hkm.com/football to see the entire database, contract rankings. It's pretty cool stuff. But when a college football coach gets fired, there is a big cost here to say goodbye. What did you guys learn?
Definitely. So we call these the golden parachute provisions. And oftentimes those are built into almost every one of these football coaches' contracts. It's one of the categories we looked at in terms of ranking these college football contracts. And it's not uncommon or not dissimilar from a CEO's golden parachute, where if the coach is fired short of the length of their contract, they earn a payoff provision. In other words, the school owes them X number of dollars for departing early on the contract. Sometimes that's a lump sum. They owe them $1 million or something if they fire them. Sometimes it's based on length of service. So if a coach has a 7-year contract and they're fired in year 5, they owe them for 2 more years of the contract. And those provisions can have significant ramifications for a school, but they can also have be massive protections for a coach who signs a contract. If they know that contract is effectively guaranteed by a golden parachute provision, they're going to be more likely to take a risk on a contract.
I really appreciate the work you guys have done here. I know that, you know, you're marrying a passion with your profession here, so I applaud you for that. I think anybody should. Where do you stand on the Pac-12 stuff? Just as a fan, Jason, does the Pac-12 need to get busy playing, or are you okay where they're at?
You know, look, it's a great question, and they're tough. They're tough questions to answer, right? I would certainly defer to and leave the decisions on safety to those people who are in a position to make those decisions. But look, I'm a football fan, and it's disappointing to see the Pac-12 not playing right now. Thank goodness we got a little relief with some college football across the country this weekend, and we got some NFL games on Thursday and Sunday. And so, look, I think the fact that we don't have a uniform decision across the NCAA as to who's playing is going to create some real sticky issues, potentially sticky legal issues down the road. I hope everybody can get back on the field and do it safely and do it soon. But those are tough, tough decisions that I don't envy the decision makers who are in those positions.
I appreciate what you do. Thanks for joining us. It's Jason Ritterizer of HKM Employment, hkm.com/football for the good stuff. Leave it here. You got the BFT. Every day on the show, we do the Culligan Water Cooler Report. Here we go.
Welcome to the Culligan Water Cooler Report. If we're talking about it, they'll be talking about it. Brought to you by Culligan Water Company.
Go to CulliganOfOregon.com if you want clean water. Get your water tested, for crying out loud. Know what you're drinking. Do what we did. CulliganOfOregon.com. Biggest surprise from the NFL weekend. Man, I'm sifting through this. I think Philadelphia losing so badly to the NFL team in Washington is what surprised me the most of the weekend. I'm not surprised that Tom Brady had some struggles. I didn't expect to pick 6, but I thought the Saints were a tough week one matchup for him. I also thought the 49ers without some receivers would be pretty limited, although I thought they would still win the game. Judah Newby, your big surprise from the NFL weekend.
I really liked the Colts this year, and
yeah, that's a weird one. Jacksonville got them.
Unreal. I mean, they got Jacksonville 16 rookies on their opening day roster. Gardner Minshew, 19 of 20, 3 touchdowns. You got your rookie 9th overall pick, C.J. Henderson, defensive back, an interception and a big-time pass breakup on 4th down late in the game. I thought Phillip Rivers, T.Y. Hilton, that run game, Frank Reich, I thought they were going to just demolish the Jaguars. I thought the Jaguars were going to tank, and they come out, and they beat the Colts 27-20. I really liked the Colts to win the AFC South this year, and that's a stinker for them. I'm more disappointed in Indianapolis than I am excited for Jacksonville. I still think Jacksonville is probably a 4 or 5 win team, but good for them showing some fight.
49ers with the inside track on Trevor Lawrence right now. that is, I was surprised Jimmy Garoppolo looked so bad. And he's getting some, he's getting a pass a little bit because all the wide receivers were hurt and they were down to, you know, basically some scraps, but he missed some open throws. He didn't look good.
For sure. And Kittle got hurt right before halftime. He played the second half, but he was not targeted at all in the second half. So I'm not sure if Shanahan let Kittle play and just told Jimmy G, look, we're not throwing the ball to George. We're going to try to win this game without him. And he was just out there as a decoy. But yeah, I don't know, John. Like, you got probably need Samuel back. The big play to Mostert was fun, but you got to have some guys back for that that offense to function on all cylinders.
They were very limited. I felt like I was playing Tecmo Bowl, and they had 4 plays, and it was like they were just running the same stuff over and over. And they moved the ball fine. It's just, you know, they got a punt blocked. Garoppolo missed some open receivers. He was too slow on the last throw of the game. Receiver was open. He just didn't get the ball there in time, and the window closed. So he looked like a young quarterback who was waiting to see the receiver be open before he would release the ball instead of trusting that the receiver would be open and throwing the guy open. So big criticism for Jimmy G in the Bay Area, plus the loss of DeForest Buckner in free agency for the Niners. Massive loss. But I think the biggest surprise was I'm in one of those elimination pools,
mm-hmm.
where you get survivor pools where you got to just pick a winning team every weekend. And I was down to, I didn't pick the Eagles, but I felt like the Eagles were a pretty good bet to win in the opening week. I got away from it. I picked Baltimore to beat Cleveland, and they did. That was an easy pick, I thought, an easier one. But I looked at the Eagles and I went, huh, the Eagles, I like the Eagles in that game. And they got beat.
They've got a lot of offensive line injuries. Carson Wentz played really bad in the second half. And Washington is interesting because the optics on them is, you know, all negative. Daniel Snyder, horrible leadership, pretty bad person. Ron Rivera, great person, great leadership, battling cancer, you know, trying to bring something out of this Washington football season. And that defensive line, John, is so good and so deep. Chase Young was awesome. And they came out and won that game big time in the second half, outscoring Philly 20-0 in that second half. Yeah, but it's tough because I would have taken Indianapolis in a survivor, and they flat out lost. I don't know, man. Week one gives all sorts of different surprises.
All right, who do you like in the games? You got the Steelers and the Giants, the 4:15 game, and then the 7:10. Tennessee Titans defense against the Denver Broncos. Who do you like in those games?
I'm taking the road teams in both. I like Pittsburgh to win big on the Giants. I think Daniel Jones is actually pretty good, but I think Pittsburgh's going to be one of the better teams in the AFC. So Pittsburgh to win by 2 scores and Tennessee to win by a touchdown. I think they'll cover the 3 on the road. I'm out on Drew Lock right now. I know he's a polarizing quarterback. I'm out on Drew Lock right now.
But, are we going to see Jadeveon Clowney in a Titans uniform on week one?
I think so. Yeah, it should be right. I haven't heard to
he's
the...
He's ready, huh?
Yeah.
He just suits up and he goes.
He's an interesting player. I mean, he's better run defender than a pass defender, but you're a Niner fan, John. You remember that Monday night game.
Yeah, like, he won that game.
He freaking wrecked it. He won the game. So he's got a little bit of that in him, but he's not like this elite pass rusher that people want to, you know, praise him as. He'll be good in that system, though.
I wonder how many games he'll play. That's the thing I keep coming back. Does he play in?
Sure.
Does he make 12 games? You know, does he? Or that's the over. I'll say 12.5. You taking the over or under?
I'll take the over on that, but that is definitely the concern. Meanwhile, the Broncos being without Von Miller, you know, that injury late in the preseason or non preseason, I should say, that's going to hurt them as well.
He also said he was scared as hell of coronavirus. He's had a tough 2020.
Paid millions of dollars. So
yeah, but, you know, I'm not saying it's like, you know, he's like the people who have lost their homes, you know, in fires, you know, but it was like he has an injury. He got coronavirus. He had, obviously he said that, you know, we keep saying it's been a weird year.
Yeah.
I'll go further. I think this year's just been hell. I mean, and I will say, like, well, let's frame this with the wildfires and the people who have lost loved ones to COVID-19. It's like, I think we're going to look back at 2020, and I think I'm hoping that it is sort of a hiccup, an aberration. I remember 2 weeks into the pandemic, I said on the radio show, I said, what if this is the new normal for a while? I was kind of having one of those down moments, and I had a listener who emailed me and said, don't feed that narrative. You know, this is going to be like a 2-week thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. I here we are, you know, and and you and I out there, if we're listening to this, if your home is standing and you haven't lost a loved one or you haven't lost your job, I think we're all kind of feeling blessed like that. Hey, you know, pretty much status quo is, you know, has been our thing. And I'm thinking about all the families out there that have lost, you know, things and loved ones and property and their homes, and they're bewildered right now. Again, you can go to baldfacetruth.org if you want to help a family that's in need. That is the Culligan Water Cooler Report. We do it every day. The 2 at 2 is coming up on the other side of this quick break. I want you to leave it here. You got the Bald Face Truth statewide on the Bald Face Truth Radio Network. Leave it here.
BFFT. Live from the home studios, presented by High Caliber Millwrights. Here's John Canzano with the Bald Face Truth.
Alabama Adriana got on an airplane, I think, last week. Gone over the weekend. How'd that go? What was that like?
It was not as scary as I thought it was going to be. It was, I mean, you're always going to have that little bit of anxiety, but I think that we were really, like, as safe as possible. So, yeah, I think it went well.
Give me an idea, because I have not been into an airport since coming back from the Pac-12 tournament in Las Vegas in March. Going through security, mask on, mask off, you know, getting on the plane. Did you have somebody next to you on the plane? How did that go?
Security was like the shortest I've ever seen. It was just basically no one there. Most of the restaurants and shops and stuff are closed. When you get to the gate, everybody's spaced out. There's signs on the chairs, just like on the MAX and the buses. There's signs on the chairs to keep them spaced apart. And then on the plane, the airline that I was flying, thankfully spaced out everybody. The middle seats were all taken out. Nobody was assigned there.
Kept your mask on the whole time?
Yeah, mask on the whole time. The flight attendants would kind of nudge you if you had it off for too long. Obviously, if you're eating or drinking, then you can. But even I, like, eating stuff, like eating crackers or whatever, I would, like, eat the cracker, then put the mask on and chew. And take the mask off, put the cracker, put it up and chew. You know, like, it was very, very secure.
It's weird times. I went through the Starbucks drive-thru and then got my iced coffee, had my mask on, and then I went to take a drink with my mask still on. Have we all done that? Have you
yep.
Has everybody jabbed a straw into your mask at least once?
Yep.
You had a newbie?
Oh, yeah. Duh, definitely been there. We're going side pocket a lot of the time with that.
What are we supposed to do? I get annoyed when I see people who are like, there was a guy, I mentioned the guy in Target. He was eating the delicious bag of Target popcorn. I know it's good, but he had his mask around his neck. And he's just, like, eating popcorn. I'm like, that's not essential. Can you just wait till you go outside? I have a condition, and here's my condition. I am annoyed by rudeness. I don't know if it bothers other people in this way. I don't think it bothers my wife in this way. Like, when I see somebody who is doing that, it bothers me. Like, not in a way where I fly into a rage, but it's like, it kind of gets under my skin, and I look at it, and I literally... I walked by the guy and I'm like, you're rude. You know, like that's selfish. And that bothers me more than, and people cut in line. It doesn't even have to be cutting in line on me. Am I unusual in this way that like, I feel like rudeness from other people chaps me in a way maybe it shouldn't. And if I see, like, if Adriana's walking at a distance and I see some guy who's going through the door and he doesn't hold the door for her, I would look and go, that's a rude person. And it kind of puts, it gets me like in a little snarl. Judah, is that unusual?
It depends on how you react to it for sure, because a lot of times people might be doing quote-unquote rude things without knowing it. I remember when I was a kid and me and my family, we went to you know, some Christmas concert or whatever, and I wore my hat into the, you know, cathedral, and we were sitting down, and someone tapped me on the shoulder. And oh, and I brought up my phone, too. I had my hat on. Yeah. I brought up my phone. They tapped me on the shoulder. And it was this woman, you know, she's probably in her 30s with her, you know, husband. She's like, that's really rude of you to do. And here I am, like, I'm just, you know.
Which part? The phone? Or was it a top hat or like a baseball cap? Or do you have Abe Lincoln's hat on? Or what are we talking about here?
No, I wish I had Abe Lincoln's hat. But no, it's just normal.
In a theater?
Yeah, it was a beanie and a, it was a beanie. Yeah, I mean, it's crying out loud. It's cold outside. So it's a beanie. Yeah. I walk in, I have my phone. You know, I'm in high school at this point. And she's like, you should take off your hat. We're in a, you know, place of worship and be off your phone. And I, you know, had a lot of pride, so it stung me the wrong way. I was like, come on, like, I know why I'm here and all that. You know, why are you getting mad at me? But looking back, I'm like, yeah, that probably is rude. I needed someone to talk to me like that. So I was probably the guy that was eating Target popcorn when I was that age.
I have a
question. Why is it rude for people to wear hats during, like, the national anthem or church? Why is that?
The church thing is like, I don't know, there's scriptural ties to, like, you know, wanting to have your head uncovered, you know, before the Lord as you're, you know, worshiping or praying. And I understand that even, but people even take that, I think, a little too far. I think it's a sign of respect. You know, you take your hat off. It's almost like a sign of humility, if you will, that there's something higher than you. I couldn't tell you anything further than that, but I think that's the same reason for the anthem. It's a sign of respect. You take something from up on top of you, and you're showing a little humility and respect to something else. But yeah, it still rubbed me the wrong way.
I think it goes back to it was seen as a long time sign of respect for, you know, even back in medieval Europe. As I was researching while you guys were talking there, apparently knights who failed to remove their helmets or lift their visors to identify themselves could face fatal consequences. Also in Christianity, it was considered customary for men to remove their hats upon entering the church. Women in churches were allowed to keep hats on unless they were blocking someone's view. That raises a memory for me as a kid. I used to sit behind this woman in church as a kid, and she would wear a giant hat. I remember that, just studying her hat during the thing. But I think it's seen as a sign of respect, and it's seen as rude if you leave your hat on. There are exceptions. Men are allowed to keep their hats on when they're indoor at athletic events. Women are allowed to keep their hats on in a lot of places. Men aren't, even at weddings or movies or even during the national anthem. I've seen women keep their hats on, but I think etiquette is interesting. That you hit on something there, Adriana. Like, you know, because sometimes we do things and we don't know why we do things.
I like, love knowing the why. I always, that's like really important to me.
We should get to the bottom of that. I'll get an expert on etiquette on the show tomorrow, guarantee you. And here's another one I have. Okay. I understand that it's gentlemanly to hold the door when a woman is coming. And I especially feel an obligation to hold the door if it is sort of an older, elderly woman who is approaching. I'll hold it a lot longer. But what is the correct length of time to hold a door? What if you're in between and you're in that area where you see somebody coming, but you're literally going to be standing there for 25 or 30 seconds? Do you still hold the door? Like, sometimes I do if I'm not in a hurry because I, you know, it's like, hey, I'm going to do something nice here kind of moment. What's the right amount of time to hold the door?
Yeah, it totally depends on where you're going and how long you have to get there. Totally.
You got to have your periphery, like, really in the zone. Because you can't make that decision as you're at the door. Here's the thing. You got to make that decision 15, 20 feet before you get to the door, and then you got to commit.
All right. Here's another one. Do you think good-looking, attractive women get the door held more often for them than not good-looking or attractive women?
Yeah.
Like the silence there? Do you see that? You guys went quiet.
Well, hey, look, okay, I'm happily married, you know, and all that, but what was it, 3 years ago? I was a single guy, and if there was an attractive woman approaching,
you'd hold
the
it
door
for like a minute. She's coming. She might be coming in the building. She's a block away. I'm going to hold the door here.
You're like, yeah, I'll stick around. I'll listen to an extra minute of this podcast and then see what shows up around the corner. I mean, of course. I think everybody.
It would be a hell of an experiment. I think Alabama Adriana would be a great experiment. Here she is. She's like 5'9", blonde, blue eyed, probably gets the door held for like every occasion she's near a door. I would wonder if we put you in costume
and we made you look like Cruella de Vil, or we made you look like Mrs. Nelson is missing the children's book, and, you know, you are Viola Swamp. I would wonder what a day in the life of Viola Swamp would be like for you.
I just, like, hate, I really hate that.
I know.
That's why I didn't want to say anything, because I know, like, I first of all, I don't want to sound big-headed or anything like that, but I do know a lot of the time that men will tend to hold the door open for me. They tend to. They don't always, though. Sometimes I think that's kind of rude, especially if they're walking right in front of me. They just let it slam right on my face. I'm like, all right, well. But no, I really, like, loathe that about our society, that it just depends on what you look like. I really, like, resent that.
I'm going to say something here that might cause me a lot of grief. I was with Anna. We were at Costco. This was about a week or two ago. And we were loading the groceries back into the car after the Costco visit. And we didn't get boxes, so everything's just loose. It's this horrible experience where you realize, like, everything's going to be rolling around in the car. And so we're putting all the stuff in the car. And then it was really important to me that Anna didn't put the cart back. She always does that. Because she's like, you know, she's this tough, independent. She grabs the cart and goes. So I was holding the cart with one hand, like, I'm not going to let you do that. I'm going to put the cart away, because she got me last time. And so I told her, I said, you get in the car. Let me take the cart. I'm going to feel rude if you have to put the cart away. Yeah. So I wheel the cart over and put it into the cart dispensary, or wherever it's supposed to go, that little collection gate that it goes into, the little corral for the carts if they were little, rodeo things. So I put the cart in, and as I'm walking back, I see a woman who is loading her groceries that is literally going, I'm going to pass by her as I go back to our car. So I looked, and I looked at her, and I couldn't help but notice she was heavy. She was large. And I stopped because she was almost done. I let her finish, and I said, I'll take the cart for you. Her reaction to that was worth $1 million to me, because she was blown away that I would take the cart back. So I took the cart, I put it back in the receptacle, and I got into the car with Anna, and we had a discussion about this. And I said to Anna, I said, I bet you, if you were in the parking lot of Costco and you were unloading like that, I bet you dudes would all the time go, I'll get that cart for you. And I wonder if people would do it for people who were not as attractive. I wonder if that would happen, and kind of fit dovetails with that. And then she said, were you looking for, like, the response from her? Is that what you would? And I said, no, I just felt like doing something nice for her. And she was a stranger. And I wondered, as she pulled away, if it even registered with her. But I don't know. Do you find yourself doing stuff like that?
I feel like I try to live my life with as little gender norms as possible. Like with the cart thing, I've never heard of that before. Like that it's the respectful thing for somebody else to take the cart, or like the man to take the cart. I don't know. I've never heard that before. I like to hold my own door open. If a guy or a man that I'm dating or something wants to do like the chivalrous thing, yeah, that's fine. But I don't know. It doesn't really affect me that much. It's not going to make or break my relationship if he does or doesn't do certain things. As long as he treats me like a person with respect and like love and all that, then that's really all I care about.
I might be weird like that, because with Anna growing up, you know, she grew up with her family running that 28-unit motel. And she, as a kid, cleaned toilets in that motel, right? I mean, that was part of the job when they cleaned the rooms. To this day, I don't like her to clean a toilet in our house for that reason. And it's not that I don't think she can do it. I don't want to, like, I'm not trying to disable her or anything. I just go, like, she's cleaned a lifetime of toilets.
No,
I don't want her to do that in our house.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And I understand men who want to be, like, super chivalrous and thoughtful, respectful in their own ways and do that for whatever reasons they want to. I'm just speaking for me personally.
All right. Coming up, we're going to visit one of the sites that is responsible for taking care of people who have lost everything in these wildfires. For those of you who want to give to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund, you can do that at baldfacetruth.org. Up next, you'll hear from a gentleman whose organization is helping. I want you to leave it here. was a big day on this radio show, not because sports were happening, but I felt like it was one of those days where you guys, the listeners, us, we all became or reminded each other that we're part of a community. The wildfires that have raged across our state and in a lot of cases have devastated some small communities, devastated some homeowners and families. There's been a loss of life. There's been a lot, tremendous loss of property. Firefighters are still out there fighting those fires on the front lines. We came together on Friday and continue to come together. We created the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. You can go to baldfacetruth.org to give if you want to give right now. You can make a tax-deductible donation there. One of the organizations that has been just tremendous in helping those who had to evacuate or those who have lost everything is the Milwaukee Portland Elks Lodge. Scott White is with that organization, and he's joining us. Anna has also stepped into studio. Anna, you got a chance to be at that Elks Lodge location on Sunday and do a tour with me. What were your takeaways?
A couple things. I mean, they pointed out to us when we arrived that the people who remain now and who are camped out are the people who probably don't have much or anything to go home to, because they had a flood of people show up, but many of those people were just temporarily staying there while, you know, they couldn't be in their homes because of evacuation. So the people who remained camping in tents, breathing, you know, all of this smoky air, are people who really are in need. I was so moved by the members of the Elks Lodge who were there around the clock sorting through donations. They were telling us that, you know, businesses were just dropping off massive amounts of, like, tangible donations, like socks and food. But they were cycling through all of those things. And, you know, it was just the show of humanity there was so moving.
63,000 square foot building at this Elks Lodge. It's got about 6 acres of property on McLaughlin Boulevard. And Scott White, who is the head of the Elks Lodge, is joining us now. Scott, first of all, thank you for what you guys are doing. I appreciate you.
Oh, you're more than welcome, my friend. It's been our pleasure. I got the call on Wednesday, and Thursday morning I decided to implement this. Got a hold of our board of directors, and I said, what do you guys think? They said, definitely. It went out on our Facebook page, and it also went out to our members, and I just couldn't believe, I was overwhelmed on the amount of people that actually needed our help. We've still got people here. We've got about 10 RVs that are still staying down here in our lower park. One family came in from Beaver Creek, and they still can't go home. We've got, I don't know, all together about maybe 40 people still left here down in our park between RVs and tents. People left their homes not knowing. You know, the first responders came in and said, you've got to evacuate. The fire's getting too close. All they did was throw clothes on their back, throw everything in their car that they could, and they had nowhere to go. And so we're lucky enough that we have the availability to have some people show up here. And when we opened it up to our volunteers and our community, the community absolutely has just blown us away as far as their donations. Dave's Killer Bread stepped up and made a big donation. Reese's made a big donation. Last night, for all the people in the park, Olive Garden up here on Sunnyside Road brought down dinner for everybody. It's amazing when you have a crisis like this, how big everybody's heart is that steps up and helps you. It's blown me away.
Yeah, I feel the same. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if it means even more right now, because it feels like our country is so divided. We're so divided in so many ways. And to be able to come together to help people is particularly gratifying. You don't want to see people in this position, obviously, but to see people reach out with their hearts in this way. I would love to know, what are your needs now? Because are your needs tangible donations? Or do you need volunteers? Where do you go from here?
the community has been incredible as far as volunteering. In fact, even some of the campers that are down here that have the needs that we're giving have actually come up and said, can we give back? Can we volunteer, help you sort through clothes, help you do anything? And we opened our arms up and said, yeah, we'll take as much help as we can. We put an ATV out for tents and sleeping bags and blankets. And the next thing you know, we've got pickups and trailer loads of tents and blankets and pillows and sleeping bags and all of that. If you got a second, I'll give you a little bit of history about the Elks. When 911 hit, a Grand Lodge stepped in and said that it's mandatory for every lodge to do a 911 ceremony around that date. So Wednesday night at our lodge meeting, being the exalted ruler, I did a 911 ceremony. And then on Friday, which was the 11th, I think it was it Saturday or Friday? The days are running so rampant right now. Anyways, on September 11th, I put the PA system up down here in the park, and I gathered everybody around, and we actually did our 911 ceremony again. And I told them, I said, I don't want you to feel any worse than you do right now, but I want to give you a little bit of history about the lodge. And we did our 911 ceremony that speaks about the 9/11 and the people that we lost and the heroes that we have and the first responders and everything that happened. And when we were done, as I was walking out, there were four people that stopped me and said, and they're bawling, which in turn made me cry. And I'm 6 foot, 240 pounds, and they made me cry, and they said, you can't believe how much that meant to us. It took our minds off of what we're going through now and remembering what we went through 19 years ago. And they said, that was the most incredible thing we've ever seen. And I said, well, that's what we do as Elks. We're here to help the community wherever we can and however we can. And that's why we stepped up to the plate and we're doing what we're doing.
Scott White is with us, head of the Milwaukee Elks Lodge number 142. You've got 6,300 square feet there, which was a blessing. I think, you know, we toured through it. We saw the water and the clothes and the socks and the diapers and the medical supplies and toiletries that people who are leaving their homes with nothing all were sort of walking through and collecting what they could. Also, our listeners came together on Friday, raised some money. We're continuing to raise money. The Bald Faced Truth Foundation, the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund, donated to your cause to help you help the people that are with you.
One of your volunteers that I was speaking with, Kay, was saying that there were families on site that needed cash right away. Like, they needed cash to be able to move on to whatever their next step might be. They might have had insurance, you know, to cover, but that insurance money, it's going to take some time to come in. She was saying that, you know, there were families that needed basic parts to their cars so they could physically move on to their next location. Can you give us an idea of some of the other physical needs that the donations that were given by the listeners of the show and the supporters of the foundation will be helping with?
You bet. We had a lady come in on Sunday, I think it was yesterday morning, and when she walked in the door, her tennis shoes were actually burnt. That's how close to the fire she was. She was distraught. She was disorganized. She had special needs. She has a daughter that's in a wheelchair that has special needs, and they had to leave their hotel room here on McLaughlin today. So we took some of that money. My wife got on the phone and called the Monarch Hotel, and we reserved a room for her from now until Friday. And then I also gave one of our knights, Mike Kronk, our loyal knight this year, I gave him $100. He ran up and got the medications that she needed. So we got her all hooked up, and we had some caretakers come in and talk to her, settle her down, and she was able to go back to her hotel. And I just checked on her about an hour ago, and she's now at the Monarch, and they just can't believe the friendliness that everybody has given.
All right,
so
Scott,
that's one way we're using the money.
I appreciate you, Scott, and I appreciate what you and your volunteers are doing there to support people and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, obviously, Anna, the money that was raised on Friday that we I was blown away, first of all, by the way that everybody came together on Friday's show. It was one of those shows where I ended up, like, it wasn't about sports. It was so much bigger. Now there are needs, of course, in places like Detroit, Southern Oregon, other places, and for people who have donated money, the board members, the advisory board members, are now looking at where those funds need to be allocated to help people today, because that's really what this is about. It's like getting people a bridge to insurance or getting people a bridge to whatever is next, because there are town like Detroit. I saw 70% of the buildings in that town gone.
Well, yeah, and in Southern Oregon, in Talon, and in Phoenix, outside of Medford. So we, you know, part of our job as of the foundation and as the board of the foundation is to vet the different entities that, the money will go toward to make sure that, you know, your money is going to stay here in Oregon and it will go to help the people that badly need it right now. We're not going to be sitting on these funds for very long, because we want to disseminate it as quickly as it comes in. And I know there's a lot of families out there that are literally just, they don't know what to do. They're not sure of where to go. And like you heard Scott say, you know, the lady now at least has like 5 days of breathing room just to kind of hatch a plan for what comes next. And I can't even imagine being in that situation. So, I just want to thank everybody that has offered their help and has been so generous with their hearts.
I know people give and they say, look, we're giving because we want to support other Oregonians. But I also feel like they're giving because they say, hey, we trust that the Bald Faced Truth Foundation is going to find the people who need the help. And I can tell you, we don't take it lightly. And I know the very first dollars that were used out of the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. I keep saying wildlife family fund. This is not about ostriches and cheetahs. This is about families that have lost so much or maybe have had to evacuate their homes. The very first $500 that was spent out of that fund went for welcome bags that were for people who were evacuated. And what was in the welcome bag? Because you were there when those bags got purchased.
Yeah. So, it was the most basic of things. It was like, you know, men's razors, shaving cream, toothbrushes, some toys for, you know, kids who have left their homes and maybe just were able to grab one item on their way out, and things to help pass the time. Very basic essentials that went into 25 welcome kits for evacuees that they would receive upon arrival, just to tide them over for a couple of days, you know, again, until they could bridge the gap until the next step.
You can give at baldfacetruth.org, tax-deductible donation in most cases. I'm not supposed to say it's tax-deductible. I'm supposed to say it may be tax-deductible because I don't know your tax return. But it's a 501c3, and if you give, you get a receipt. So take care of people in our community. Take care of people in our state. I know that, you know, a lot of people have been moved from level one or level two or level three. Everybody's kind of being downgraded slowly, but those fires are still out there. The firefighters are still out there. You tweeted a photograph this morning of a firefighter who was on the floor sleeping at the firehouse. And such a powerful image.
Yeah, that one brought me to tears because it was, I mean, obviously, you know, they're are probably sleeping arrangements at the firehouse. And from what I understand, he's, you know, he eventually went back home to rest, but he was just literally collapsing on the floor to rest from the exhaustion of fighting the wildfires. He's with Malala Fire and the cousin of someone I know. And I just thank you isn't even enough. Like, I don't know how to thank the first responders who were out there, many of whom lost their own homes.
Yeah, there have been some cases
while they were protecting other people's homes.
I saw a story as well in Southern Oregon where it was these images that were people driving backhoes and tractors, and they were fighting the fire, and they weren't even firefighters. They were farmers. They were contractors who had access to heavy machinery. And they were literally creating a fire line to try to keep the fires from affecting people's homes. We're at the point of the show where you cry.
This is like...
It's good, though. You play with emotion. It's one of the things I love about you.
I swear.
You play with a lot of emotion.
I don't know. I don't know why. It just moves me so much. I guess I do know why, because it's so far beyond what I would be willing to do, I guess. Like, I can't even put myself in the shoes of somebody.
It's selfless.
It's so selfless to, like, abandon. And I know people can say, oh, it's just their job. It's what they've signed up to do. Whatever. But, like, it's not my job to go and leave my family behind and go protect other neighborhoods and other families and other homes from burning while mine potentially is in the path of danger. It's just really hard to fathom.
I think about the families of those firefighters, too, because in one case, our first graders has a classmate whose father is a firefighter. Mm-hmm. And you were texting a little bit with the family. He was off fighting the fires, and the family was at home here.
Yep.
And they were at, like, stage
two
of evacuation. Mm-hmm. And dad's 100 miles away fighting a fire. Like, that's not easy on the family as a whole, as a unit. Mom has got, you know, twin kids at home and is trying to pack up and, you know, imagine what they're going to do.
Yeah, understandably nervous.
They're not twins, are they? They're a year apart. Are they twins?
No,
I think they are twins.
They're not twins.
I think they are twins.
They're like 2 years apart, but they...
People say that about our kids, though.
Yeah.
People look at our kids and they're like, are they twins? And I'm like, really? 2 years apart? All right. Leave it here. You got the Bald Faced Truth statewide. If you want to give, go to baldfacedtruth.org. Right now, you can make a tax-deductible donation to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. Anna, you were emotional in the last segment of radio, and I'll have people know she doesn't walk around once a day having a moment like that. I think that it does have to do with helping people. It does have to do with you seeing the images and realizing that other people out there are being selfish. Selfless, sorry. She cries when she sees selfish people.
Yeah.
Somebody doesn't hold the door, she bursts into tears. I want to play a news report that is coming out of ABC4 television in Utah that is causing a stir on social media. I'm going to play the whole report. Alabama Adriana, are you tuned in? Are you listening to this?
Yes.
Okay. I want you to hear this. Judah, are you hearing this?
Yeah, I know where you're going with this one.
All right.
Now hundreds have gathered here in front of the Washington County Administration Building calling for the end of a mask mandate, saying they are tired of not living their normal lives.
No more masks! No more masks!
Not on the backs of my kids, or you're going to get more federal funding. That's how I feel about that.
A passionate call for action Friday morning in St. George. Several police officers on standby as many locals called concerns about coronavirus spikes overblown.
The flu kills more than coronavirus.
Others calling the virus a hoax or stating that asymptomatic carriers simply do not exist and they cannot be forced to wear masks anywhere as citizens of the United States.
If we want to wear a mask, that's fine. We can take care of ourselves.
Some rally attendees say they shouldn't ever wear masks if they have any medical issues or mental health concerns or if they feel they simply can't breathe.
When George Floyd was saying, I can't breathe, and then he died, and now we're wearing a mask, and we say, I can't breathe, but we're being forced to wear it anyway.
But many say that they believe in all cases, masks jeopardize kids' health. Parents are demanding they have the right to decide what to do with their children.
I'll tell you another reason I'd hate masks. Most child molesters love them.
School administrators responding that they don't understand why crowds are protesting them based on a mandate given by the governor.
They blocked off the front entrance to the school building, and we went out to ask them to move, and they attempted to storm the school building.
The school board is implementing the governor's recent order that face shields alone are not enough. And if a parent is adamant that their child cannot wear a mask or a shield, they must fill out a form, including a doctor's note, so the district can review it. In St. George, Katie Crowlis, ABC4 News.
All right, there's ABC 4 News in suburban North Salt Lake as it pertains to this story. I want your reaction to that. I almost feel like it's not real. I had to look it up. That's from Friday. Alabama Adriana, go.
Those people are what's wrong with this country.
Judah.
I'm similarly stunned that it is real. I think it's the quotes that really get me, like the people talking, comparing it to George Floyd.
George Floyd knocked me out of my chair.
To child molesters liking that. That is unbelievable. I think we're starting to get to the point where, too, like if you're a news organization, like, do you have to use everything as jarring as it is, or can you show a little bit? Is there a maturity discussion as a news organization to not, you know? I mean, at the same time, you want to show the picture of the actual things that are happening too. But
right,
I'm like, golly, that is terrible. I would be ashamed if I knew or considered anybody like that my friends. I would be ashamed, and they wouldn't be my friends anymore.
Anna, you've been on the news side of that. What are we seeing there? Are we in sweeps right now? What, September 14th?
No, not sweeps. No, but I mean, to counter what you're saying, though, Judah, I think the people who were quoted in there, like, there are people in this country who truly feel that way. Like, they like it or not, they actually represent people across the country who feel very strongly that the masks either don't work or that this is a hoax, coronavirus is a hoax, or that masks are actually detrimental to your health if you wear them. So I think it actually is important for us to hear from those people in a way, because it reminds us, like, wow, not everybody's on the same page here. Like, we can't live with blinders on and go, oh, wow, everybody has the same level of caution and has seen the scientific evidence and has the same takeaways that a lot of other people do.
It still makes me mad, though. I think the one that is super inflammatory is the George Floyd thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, and I think they know that, you know, as they're producing that. Don't they know that's going to be, that's a lightning rod bit of sound there?
Yeah, because the reporter and the photographer who interviewed that lady, you know, their jaw is going to drop when they hear that. And you can bet that makes it into the story.
Like, they look at each other afterwards like, oh, that was great sound.
Yeah.
Like, they make a mental note of what time it is on the time. What's the time stamp on the video when they get that sound? And the old lady who's yelling, child molesters, love the mass.
Yeah, that's a pretty broad statement.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. It still makes me mad, and I still think those people are dumb.
But do you think, John, that it is detrimental to our country to show those extremist, I'm sorry to call them extremists, but, you know, to show those...
Yeah, they are extreme. They're storming a school. They're going to storm an elementary school over the masks instead of going and saying, okay, let's look at the data, let's look at the science, let's try to get the state health officials to change their mind. Like, really? They're going to protest a school, an elementary school, and charge the school doors?
Should a journalist not use that quote because it helps to erode the fabric of our society?
I've always wondered if we took the media away from any kind of protest, not just this protest, how would it take the air out of the protest?
Right.
And I think that's the true measure of the, like, if they were still out there, if there's no media coverage and they're still out there and they're still going, this is what we believe in, we're going to march. I have more respect for that than if they're alerting media and going, hey, we're holding a rally and we're going to march, come cover it. You know, I think it's worth covering. Because for the point you said that it's going to, like, it really it knocked me out of my chair because I was like, people are still doing this and they're doing it with enthusiasm.
Yeah, fervor.
But I also reserve the right to look at them and go, they're a bunch of idiots. Look at them. And I kind of hope, like, I'm looking at them.
Sorry, did you just snort?
I kind of look at them and I'm like, you know what? I see groups like that. And I got to be honest with you. I can't help but wonder, like, are they going to have a widespread, you know, infection, like, is that going to be a super spreader event?
Yeah.
And if so, kind of feel like, well, maybe some of them will change their minds.
But what I'm saying is there is, and I don't know what the percentage of the population is, there is a percentage of the population that does think that the COVID numbers are blown out of proportion.
I know. I hear from them.
Yeah.
They're rallying for a return to college football. Like, hey, it's, you know, the and here's the one that gets me is when people say, well, only 6% has been attributed to COVID, 6% of the data. And then I see like actual data that shows the overall mortality rate of this country, like the number of people who die in a given year, like last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we're at plus 200,000 and we're in September.
Okay.
On an average year.
Okay.
So we're already 200,000 above an average year.
Mm-hmm.
What do we think is attributing to that? Like, what is causing 200,000 more people to die this year than in an average year? And if you don't say coronavirus, you're failing the intelligence test. Mm. Like, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. 503-417-7575. What do you think? Well, she has cried on air. She has snorted on air. She has talked on air today. And I appreciate you being part of the show.
Oh, no problem. Just here to help.
Chad has called in. Chad, what's up, man? How are you doing?
Hey. Good. How are you?
We're doing well.
First, I just want to congratulate you again. I called on Friday. I just want to congratulate you again on everything that you're doing in this time. And you know, when Anna was crying, it made me cry. And I've been told by my friends on Facebook that, you know, I shouldn't have an opinion on what's happening in Oregon because I don't live there anymore. But I, you know, I was born and raised there, grew up there for 34 years. And so to me, it's personal. And you guys are just doing such a great service. And it's awesome.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's just, you know, everybody can do their part. Everybody has their role. And like, I got kids at home. I can't go fight fires. And, but we have this platform and we can bring people together in this way. And so we're just doing what we can.
I want to thank Peter Delzato, who gave a donation this hour. I want to thank, Robin Kwan, who gave a donation this hour. Shout out to Robin. Mark Ramsby made a donation this hour. Made a donation. Carol Ehrman made a donation. Thank you, Carol, for that. Jared Russell made a donation to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. Marcia Antanasi, thank you, Marcia, for your donation as well to the Oregon Wildfire Family Fund. And Mark Shepard, I appreciate your support. For those of you who would like to make a donation and help families that are in need in the state, and our next mission here is to get into Southern Oregon and to get into Marion County and get into the Detroit Lake area and help families there. And that'll happen in the next 8 to 10 hours as we start to deploy some more of these funds that have been raised here on this show. But I want you to know if you can give, there's no donation that's too small, and you can also help by sharing the Bald Faced Truth Foundation's posts on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Share them on your own accounts. If you can make a donation, great. And if you can't make a donation, you just say, hey, I can't make a donation. Share that stuff. Get it to people who will make a donation. That's how you can become part of the solution here. So you can go to baldfacedtruth.org or you can go to any of the social media accounts. Anna, final 15 seconds here. Go.
Thank you, everybody, for being part of this effort, and just be thankful for all that we have today, wherever you may be.
The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.